Association, some of them pretty good. Magazine that's come out, been out for about 3 years now, called Change in Higher Education, that reports on everything worthwhile that's going on and a lot of things that aren't worthwhile that are also going on. I guess the most significant thing that's happened to me in my reflection on education is to meet a group of guys who were working on degree in administrative science at Yale and came to SMU as a funny kind of a package deal because we had a dean in business school there who thought that there was no way to teach people to be businessmen. All you could teach them to do was learn for themselves. And these guys were all specialists in learning. And I got in with them, mainly because they were the most interesting nuts on the campus, and discovered that despite the fact that I'd been teaching for 13 years, I didn't know very much about learning and how learning occurred and how to make learning occur. I probably don't know very much now. Is this thing turned on yet? Okay. Well, you can decide. I'll try to be brief enough so that we have time to talk if anybody wants to talk, or go to bed if people would rather do that. Any kind of a diagnosis, well, a diagnosis usually precedes prescription. Before the physician tells you what medicine you require, he tries to figure out what's wrong with you. I'm going to do a little diagnosis, but as you all know, every diagnosis conceals a hidden prescription. What I see is right and wrong about American education today, particularly undergraduate college education, which is where my focus will be, is not the view of some objective person disinclined to make value judgments. I have some very strong commitments to things, and I think you'll detect them. The most important thing, I believe, for a person to recognize before he thinks about the American educational system, the most important thing to recognize is that from kindergarten through graduate school, it does not exist for the benefit of the students. Oh, I'm not trying to be funny. It doesn't. It performs a whole lot of functions unrelated to the welfare of the students. It babysits, for example, and that's very important. Look what happened in Dallas. Every time it snows, we have a day off. And the parents are furious. The kids are going to be under their feet. You know, the Thanksgiving that a mother utters when September finally comes around again. It keeps the kids occupied. It performs disciplining functions. You know, many parents can't discipline their kids, so they send them to school, where the school makes them learn to do things that they ought to learn to do, like sit still for long periods of time. I think school also is a penalty box, sort of the penalty you have to pay for being young. You got to go to school. I mean, it's just not right to play all the time, is it? I catch myself up here with my kids, with Brian, who's almost 11. I say, Brian, aren't you doing any work? Aren't you doing anything? You're just playing all the time. probably wait till I'm getting back at school. School performs very important socialization functions. That's the most important socialization function. Well, some people say this, and I'm largely persuaded they're right, that the school system is conditioning people to perform tasks that are essentially meaningless to them for external rewards. And you do this not because it'll be joyful, because it'll enrich your life, but because you'll get an A for it. Because later on in life, you're going to have to do all sorts of meaningless things for the sake of the salary that comes at the end of the week. And you learn this in school, and it's very important. It holds our society together. Doesn't mean it's good. School also performs all sorts of status ascription tasks. You know, we've got to assign people the right kind of status. If your parents are wealthy, and your wife, and your father's well educated, then you're supposed to receive high status too. We can't just award that to you, you know, arbitrarily because of your parents. We first send you through many years of school, and then we award you that status. We track students so that they feel that at the end of the system that what they get is their due reward and they have no right to complain. What a college student knows that is useful to a businessman that a high school graduate does not know, I've never found out. I've done a lot of teaching in business schools. I teach economics, and economics is always closely related to business. Sometimes the economics department is in the business school. And very seriously, I don't know what it is, except maybe a little accounting. Mark, I forgot your...
I really don't. I don't know what you learn in business courses or economics courses, for that matter, that really makes a guy more useful to a corporation. As one thing's for sure, the corporation knows when it hires a college graduate that it hired a kid who was willing to sit still for 4 years and, you know, be reasonably respectable. And,
probably won't eat peas with his knife. But I'll end this list with this one, but it's a very, very important function that our school system performs. It provides income, status, and power for the people who teach, and a lot of other people who support them, the principals and the boards of education and the teachers. I mean, there are an awful lot of people in the education industry. I like to read newspaper ads. One of the most interesting ads every week is the one in the New York Times Sunday edition by Albert Shanker, who is the head of the teachers union in New York City. And Shanker is really he's excited, terribly excited, about Ivan Illich and de-schooling society, and a lot of other people like John Holt, who decided that the educational system is a complete bust. What we should do is abolish compulsory education, and for Pete's sake, the kids aren't learning anything in school anyway. They might as well have fun. That oversimplifies it, but there are a lot of people today who are arguing for the abolition of compulsory education. And, of course, the people who are making their living off education are terribly frightened by all of this. And Shanker is just very interesting to read his arguments. He's calling upon Plato, he's a union leader, enlisting Plato and Aristotle and Thomas Aquinas and everybody good. Well, in view of the fact, though, that, and actually I'm perfectly serious about everything I've said, in view of all of this, it's small wonder that in terms of any benefit-cost analysis, school flunks out. The ratio of learning to teaching is about 0.03. Now, ask yourself this. I get college freshmen. Now, they've spent the last 4 years in high school. And I wonder, what do they now know because they were in high school that they didn't know when they started high school? What extra skills and knowledge do they bring with them because they've had those 4 years of high school? They bring a lot of misinformation with them. They did bring some skills, math, but even that I find they didn't learn it. There's a rare student who's gotten interested in math who can really do something about it. But even if the student learns some math, he's learned it in such a mechanical way usually that he can't apply it outside of that for which he learned it. I've seen engineers who were quite accomplished mathematicians unable to apply the mathematics that they learned in engineering to a problem in economics, because the letters were different. What do we know about undergraduate college education today? We know that there are so many different colleges and universities that any generalization is bound to be wrong. There are bound to be exceptions to anything I say, and yet, I should add, the financial crisis of the last few years has forced a lot of schools to start innovating all over the place. You know, experimentation, innovation is the order of the day. Yet, there are surprisingly few differences among colleges. It's really amazing how little difference you will find from one college to the next, from the best to the worst. You find a difference in the quality of the teachers, the quality of the students. That's very important. They say, Harvard is one of the best places to go. And the proof is, look how Harvard graduates succeed. Aha! Uh-huh. But that's because Harvard only accepts people who are bound to succeed. If any college that could be as selective in its admissions policy as Harvard would turn out distinguished graduates. What about the value added? I know of no convincing evidence that the value added at Harvard is significantly greater than the value added at, I don't want to mention it, say Central Washington State College, close by. And then these bold new experiments, as I said, there have been lots of, they're all spelled with capital B, capital M, bold new experiments. They appear in the college catalog or brochures that are sent out. Innovation in education, they're either educating people for the 70s or now the popular thing is educating them for the 90s. Some looking toward the year 2000. It's all very exciting, but one thing I noticed is that these experiments are almost never evaluated to see whether they make any difference. We go to from pass-fail to letter grades, from letter grades to written evaluations, and we go from big classes to small classes, and audio-visual equipment is dragged in, and there's all kinds of stuff. Students plan their own courses, and of course, interdisciplinary programs all over the place. And yet there's almost no evidence that these things make any significant difference to learning, or that students are appreciably happier about going to college. The other thing that you have to notice, that we know, is that undergraduate education is dominated by the disciplines. And the disciplines are incarnate in departments, with all of their interlocking traditions and cartels and professional associations and tradition and all of their cant about discipline. A college is run by its departments, and they don't allow much change to occur. For all of the studies and reports and reforms and books that have come out since 1930 on the improvement of general education, the verdict is the mountain has labored and produced a mouse. You can go back. I've done this. I've gone back and read things like original Harvard report, Chicago report, Hutchins study, Daniel Bell's thing on the reform of general education at Columbia, and much more recent things, the Hampshire College study, and I'm kind of interested in Hampshire because they really spent a lot of work on, they really thought about it a long time before they started. But still, as you read all of these things, these criticisms of education going back to the beginning of this century, you find that the criticisms are the same, decade after decade, essentially the same, which means that college isn't changing. We jiggle a course here. It's kind of frightening to come out of a finished reading a book written a few years ago that says, the demon is such and such. If we can only get rid of this, this is the great weight that hangs down upon the system. If we can only abolish it, then we'll have real, meaningful, liberal education. Then you go back and read something written 30 years earlier that says that this very thing that now has to be abolished would be the salvation of American higher education. The mountain labors and produces a mouse. How come? There are a lot of bright people, a lot of energetic people associated with undergraduate education. Well, everybody's got a simple answer, and I got a simple answer too. The simple answer is that because students are passive learners, and there is no such thing as a passive learner. A passive learner is a non-learner. Students do as they're told until they rebel. And either both when they're doing as they're told and when they're rebelling, they're not learning anything. I'll come back to this doing as you're told business, which is the essence of passive learning. I'll try to explain exactly what I mean and what I think can be done to change that. I want to look at the forms that student rebellion takes. It takes essentially two forms. One is copping out of the educational process, and the other is changing it. Well, when you cop out, you can go, as I say, you either go the social life or the social action route, and you decide that this is too boring. I can't put up with this. You know, it happens usually about the middle of the second semester of your freshman year. You came there full of ideals, you know, and Oh, you were reading, get yourself an education, and then you join the fraternity, and you find out
where the real fun is, and you go the social life route. And what a student is saying is, social life is more interesting to me than all of this stuff that I'm supposed to do for my classes. Or, if you're a serious student, you go the social action route. You take up all sorts of causes. You picket, and you form political organizations, and you demonstrate against the war in Vietnam. And I'm not saying anything against social action, though I am opposed to social action when it is a consequence of the fact that students are bored with what's going on in the classroom, because it's not likely to be very effective. The students very quickly get bored with social action, too. The other thing that some students do is they say, well, we're going to reform the university, and sometimes they form free universities. They say, our classes are irrelevant, let's have some relevant classes. Well, I invite you to look down a list of the so-called relevant courses that students have set up in free universities. Now, again, I'm sure there are exceptions. I'm sure there are free universities. The only free universities that I know about that have had any measure of success have existed in larger cities, and their clientele have been floaters around the university, not so much students in the university as other people who use these free university classes as a way of getting together and having rap sessions. But as far as the students are concerned, they notice right away that the free university course carries no credit. And why should they spend time on a course that's not going to pay off in the coin of the realm, which is credit? If that course is worthwhile, why doesn't the university offer it and offer credit for it? Sometimes a free university course will get into the curriculum, but ordinarily not, because so many of them, of course, there's an awful lot of stuff in getting to know one another and astrology, it's pretty big, the occult, an awful lot of it. Theosophy is big stuff in free university. Sometimes students say, well, why should we set up a free university? Let's reform this one, and they get on curriculum committees. And an astute faculty helps them. It gets lots of students on the curriculum committee, because faculty members can always outsmart students on curriculum committees. Faculty have been around a lot longer, they know the ropes, and they co-opt the students. The faculty puts in a new innovative curriculum, which persuades the students who've been grumbling about all this baloney, persuades them, now we've got something new. And as soon as the bugs begin to appear, as soon as students discover it's more of the old same, just under a new guise, and they start to grumble, they said there have been no meaningful change, then the faculty says, ah, but you participated in the revision of the curriculum. Students will waste a year of their lives sitting on curriculum committees. They're continually being outsmarted by the faculty. I think that these responses, the free university and the revised curriculum responses, let the students revise the curriculum, they're worse than useless. You know, I think students wind up even more disillusioned than they were before. And that ain't going to work. Got something written here, I can't read it, let me see if it's funny. I said that the faculty sit back. Dale said you shouldn't sit under this light, but you can't see if you don't sit under this light. The reason that the faculty members are always booby-trapping the students on the curriculum committees is because faculty members have no incentive to change anything. It might be that I could gain personally from some substantial adjustment in the curriculum. Well, let's say, for example, we abolish the foreign language requirement. That happens to be a big issue at most colleges. Let's abolish the foreign language requirement. Well, the foreign language department does not care for that curriculum change. And they remind the people who teach biology and physics and chemistry that there is a science requirement. Which is also. Moreover, when you start abolishing requirements, you see, then you get a kind of a competition. Then the students start taking the courses they like,
and then they may not take your course. and it's not only that this can be tough for professors. I think that when you get this kind of bad dynamics going, you really do get the worst kind of competition among professors, competition in being popular. And that can be very, very destructive. Now, I happen to be very much in favor of competition and treating students like customers, but there's a good and a bad environment for that. And when it comes about without any planning and forethought, it can be a very, very pernicious sort of thing where faculty members have nervous breakdowns and students just get even more bored than they were before. Terribly boring to spend a semester with a professor who's determined to let you do your own thing when you don't have any idea what your thing is. I'm big on tough college administrators. I like strong presidents. In case you don't know, Mark Matthews is sitting here as a college president. He's a brand new college president.
And I'm learning.
I hope he's tough. One of the nice things that college presidents can do today is bang faculty heads together because the market is weak. You can bang faculty heads because they haven't got any other place to go. But the trouble is, even that a strong administration can get out the weeds, but it can't cultivate the flowers. That's a much more fragile task. I think that there are two things that we ought to do about education. I'll just say the one briefly because I want to get on with the other. One is we can do a lot more to bring about the benefits of competition. I would like to see us move away from state monopoly in education. Vouchers, you've heard of the voucher system at the grade school and at the high school level, so that parents and students really have some choice among schools. And at the college level, I think we have to stop subsidizing schools and start subsidizing students. Give the student a tuition grant, which he can spend at the college of his choice. I just think simple little things like this would be very, very important. Cut down on the empire building that goes on in our school systems. It's not just that the teachers and the principals and the presidents and deans and professors and all that don't care very much about the students and don't worry about education for the students. It's also true that they're not very cost conscious. From the taxpayer standpoint, this is quite disastrous, and taxpayers are beginning to rebel. Anybody who is running a state school has an incentive to spend as much money as he possibly can, because that's the only way he can justify a large budget increase for next year. And he goes to the legislature and says, "Behold, how the citizens of this commonwealth are clamoring to get in, and I need all kinds of additional money to run an adequate program." In the 60s, when this whole thing was completely out of control, some incredible empires were built up in the form of state colleges and universities. And those empires are going to be difficult to cut back to manageable size. I'm not a fan of Ronald Reagan, but it's an ill wind that blows no good. And one of the things that Ronnie's been doing is scaring the bejabbers out of a bunch of fat cats in college campuses who are playing in their playpens. Now, they wouldn't see it quite out. He's undermining essential research. I don't know, I'm sure there is essential research that goes on. Not done in economics. but the other thing that I'm more interested in is I think that students and professors and not very many students here, which is too bad. If any of this is worthwhile, you can tell them about it. I think that they can make the resources of the college work for them. And they don't have to wait until everybody gets organized. I think they will need help, but that a college student today who wants to make the resources of the college work for him can find the help that he needs. He can find it in the class which he's taking. He can, if he knows how, enlist the aid of others in gaining control of his own education. And he can do that by beginning to perform some tasks of demonstrated value. Let's see if I can explain what that means. What I'm interested in is students who take control of their own learning in their own classes. who get other students to join them in this activity, and then get the prof to join them. The best world would be if the prof started off by forcing the students to take control of their own education. I very carefully said forcing, not allowing them. If you allow a student, if you leave a student free to learn what he wants to learn, he will not learn anything. Again, there are exceptions, but I've had some, and a lot of friends have had very, very disappointing experiences with this. You know, you tell the students something like, well, I did this one semester. I walked into a class of 30 students, all of whom had signed up for this course because they wanted to. It wasn't required of anybody. They came in there, they heard the word that this was going to be very free, that they could go in directions that they wanted to go, and that I was going to help them with this. And I explained to them, it was a course in the history of economic thought. And that's the area of my specialty. I really felt competent here. And I explained to them some of the problems and questions that excited me, and oh, they were all excited, and explained how they would, it would be up to them to demonstrate to me what they had learned, and they could devise their own exams, I'd accept anything as long as they could show that it demonstrated learning. And then I just left them free. And what they did was turn to their other courses. And then they got, you know, and they admitted this. They just didn't do anything. And then they got very bored because sit around and not do anything. And they felt that they always had to come. I think because I was being such a nice guy. They always had to come to class. They would sit there and nobody read anything. Nobody thought anything. And I would say, well, what do you think about that? What Ricardo said there, you know, everybody, I said, why don't we all read this? And nobody read it. And coming again, I was all excited, jumping around up there. It doesn't work. But we shouldn't just throw the resources of the university away. I think the student who goes to college should recognize that there are enormous resources there, and the challenge to him is to make them work for him. I'll just mention some of those resources: libraries, laboratories, films, you know, things that you're not likely to find other places. Funds. Most colleges have an awful lot of funds. Students are interested in something, it's amazing, it costs a little money. They can usually find some funds around somewhere to get it. Usable spaces, that's important. Knowledgeable people. A multitude of peers. That makes for learning. A lot of people your own age with similar experiences to yourself. Curriculum. Well, that can be an aid to learning. Classes. You can even learn from a class. Lots of free time. Lots of people with a commitment to learning. At least who have bad consciences if they're not facilitating learning. Now that's a lot of resources. And from 18 to 21, those resources are available to you. And if you don't use them then, you're never going to find that many resources gathered together in one place again. But there's one great untapped resource. I'm reaching the end of my notes. And that great untapped resource is the inner experience of each student. You know what I mean? You don't. Students have learned from grade school on up that inner feeling must be left outside the classroom. That doesn't belong in the classroom. You read a poem in school, and the teacher says, well, let us discuss that. And the student says, gee, I like that. Johnny, let's discuss the poem. Now that may be a little extreme. The students have learned not to say anything like that. They also learned not to say, I hate that. They've learned not to ask, why are we doing this? What does this mean? They're running and skipping and feeling sexy and everything else out in the hallway, and then they come into the classroom, and they're supposed to leave themselves outside. I can't illustrate this. Do you know what I mean? You're supposed to be what? A mind. That's it. A mind. This is a problem for the mind. Let's not let our emotions get mixed up in this. And The key word for me in learning is interest. I would say that interest, I-N-T-E-R-E-S-T, like the interest rate. No, it's because, you know, the down with relevance. I hate relevance. I'm not talking about relevance. That's the great trap. It's amazing how fast new and relevant courses become irrelevant. Of a curriculum, of a course, of anything that goes on in school, one thing is required, that it be interesting. No one learns anything in which he is not interested. And I lay that down as an absolute rule. Nobody learns anything in which he is not interested. When you say that, how come I learned the capitals of all the 48 states? There were 48 when I went to school. Well, there are ways in which you can become interested in that. I was interested in that because it was a means to an end of showing off. Another way, you learn things because if you realize you are interested in pleasing the teacher. And so you learn these things. So you're interested in getting a good grade. But that's a terribly inefficient way to facilitate learning. I mean, it's so indirect. Oh, why is it that students are not, for the most part, or not for long, interested in what goes on in the classroom? I think the basic reason is that we have taught them there's no reason to expect to be interested. There's, none of this is supposed to grab them. This is not supposed to mean anything to them. They can analyze it intellectually, and that's all they're supposed to do. But how it affects them is irrelevant. It's not supposed to be talked about. We do not encourage our students, indeed we don't allow our students in the classroom to talk about how they feel. And they very quickly learn that how they feel has nothing to do then with education. What we should do in college, we teachers, is insist on making what we are teaching meaningful. And if we can't do that, we should have the courage not to teach. And students should ask, what does it mean? What does it mean to me? That's the only person to whom it can mean anything. What does it mean to me? I'm not saying students should run into class the first day and say, what is this whole course all going to come to? You know, summarize this. Tell me what great insights I'm getting. You can't do that. But it is legitimate to ask the teacher the first day, why are we taking this course? What does this course have to offer? Why do you think that this course will interest me? I think students should assume at the beginning that a course can be meaningful, can be made meaningful. Because I think most courses can be made meaningful. But if you make that assumption, then you should require the teacher to show how it can be meaningful. Now that's so simple that I'm ashamed to say it. And I I have an embarrassed feeling. Sometimes in thinking and talking about education. For years, I, along with a lot of other people, have been running around trying to find the answer in new revisions of the curriculum, one-third science, one-third art, one-third philosophy, you know. Small discussion groups, large lectures, using televised materials, you know, all sorts of stuff. Great books and not so great books. And I've been on the forefront of the educational innovation. What would you call it? The educational innovation swamp. I've been responsible. I've been for the last 4 years. I've been responsible for planning, staffing, coordinating, directing, defending, apologizing for, a course required of all freshmen at SMU. We have about 1,400-1,500 freshmen per year. And they're all required to take, for 2 semesters, 3 hours each semester, a course called The Nature of Man. It's kind of fun, people. You know how often it comes up, people say, well, who can tell about human nature? And I always shoot back, I say, I'm an expert on that. I'm the coordinator of the nature of man. I went into that course, you know, when I came to SMU, the course had been around for a couple of years, and it was in some trouble. And I criticized it because I knew how to do it better. And after 2 years, my criticism, it just happened that the coordinator resigned, and they said, well, since you know so much, you do it. And I knew that it was going to be a great course now when I took over. I'm not being modest when I say that in the 4 years of my administration, the course was slightly better than it had been before, but not appreciably so. It wasn't because I didn't spend time thinking about it. It wasn't because we didn't have good teachers. We did. We've got the teachers in that course. Interesting. Well, this is significant. Our teachers, by and large, didn't have very good academic credentials. But I persuaded the dean that there were 2 requirements for a person to teach in that course. One was that he wanted to teach in the course. The other was that he genuinely liked freshmen. And we had and have a great teaching staff in there. I mean, we've got some dubs, but the students will all testify to this, that a nature of man teacher, a person who teaches in the nature of man is far more likely to be one of the good teachers on campus than other people. And yet, the course was a failure. Each year, it didn't work. The students are listless. You know, they're not excited by this fantastic stuff here. And so we got to revise it. Got to throw out that book they didn't like, and use more books like this book that they liked so much. And then we find out the book they liked so much next year they don't like at all. And after long planning sessions and we worked at this and got inputs from everywhere and everybody, and each year we thought we had the answer, and I know now that we weren't looking in the right place for the answer. The course worked when it was taught by a teacher who began by taking his students seriously as human beings and did something like this. He first got to know the names of each one of them, and he made sure they knew their names. Everybody knew everybody else's name. And he got them to begin by, and it's legitimate in the nature of man, of course, to talk about who they were and to be honest with one another about how they felt. A teacher who did this, and did this well enough that he could create a high level of trust in the class he was teaching, found that he was teaching students who were learning like crazy. If a teacher failed to do this, he might give brilliant lectures, he might be witty and all of that stuff, but his students didn't learn. Now, how do I know they didn't learn? I can't prove it, but the best test, the test that I used, is how excited the students were about the course. If they were high on the books, if they were coming to class, if they were talking and arguing, if they were organizing projects, if they were doing things on their own, I assume they were learning. Some of us worked at, we employed a technique that I think is very, very good technique, a journal. And I've read the journals of some of the students in some of the courses who were taught by teachers who took trust and honesty and attention to your own experience seriously. And the difference between the quality of those journals and the quality of the ordinary student term paper or final examination, there's just a world of difference. When a student is writing about something that he cares about, he writes well. You know that? Students can write effectively. I was amazed.
For years, I joined everybody else in the faculty club and said, oh, if only they teach students how to write in the high school.
Students can write. A lot of students can't punctuate, and some students can't spell. But they can write effectively. When they care what they're writing about, they write effectively. This past summer, this poor coming up here, I was teaching a course in the humanities. And this is the experiment. I was going to describe how this course worked, but I won't do it. Unless you ask me. I still won't do it. I have to explain, first of all. See, after the student takes 6 hours of The Nature of Man, he's not through with our general education requirements. They're called liberal studies courses. He's also got to take 12 hours of humanities. That means from the Greeks to Augustine, that's the first one, then from Augustine to Descartes, then from Locke, then from Voltaire to Nietzsche, and then the 20th century. And that's the most unpopular course on campus. It's got all the great books. It's got some pretty good teachers in it, too, people who know their stuff, and students hate it. Well, why not? And why shouldn't they hate it? They don't care what Plato said in the Republic. They do not care. Now, should they care? I don't know. Why should they? There are lots of important things to be done. Who cares what Plato said in the Republic? But the interesting thing is that if a student does care what Plato says, he learns a tremendous amount from Plato. If you can persuade the student that Plato was asking even one question that he is asking, he will go at Plato and find things in Plato that you didn't know were there, and you thought you were an expert. What we did in this, the first time that the humanities course, this summer, was the first time that the humanities course had been taught in this way. I realized that they had a huge weight of dead tradition to overcome. In the summer, the students who take this course are all the students who couldn't bring themselves to take this, but I'm a bitch during the year. And so they pile up in the summer. Their hope is that the teacher, that everybody will sort of, there could be a huge class, and everybody's screwed up, they can just scoot through, Generally, the teacher will say, well, because it's a short semester, we'll drop Stendhal, and we'll only read the first part of Faust, and other things like that, and there's no time to catch up on it. So, I was supposed to teach one section, and 60 students enrolled. Well, we don't let it go above 30, so we split it into two. And these students, almost without exception, were taking this course because they had to. They had no interest in the course. We spent the first day getting to know one another, but not just going around giving their names. I sat down on the floor because I'm more comfortable on the floor. And that sort of surprised me. I know that's not terribly innovative. But you know what a difference it makes? You know something? I discovered something. Silly little, shut me up. I'm starting to meander. But I've discovered that when I'm sitting on the floor, students talk. I'm a kind of a dominant personality. And it's hard for a student to talk to me. Because I always seem to know so much. When I'm above him, just physically, it makes it harder. When I get down on the floor, students talk more. It works. Any of you do any teaching, you want to try it out. sit on the floor. I start asking the students why they're taking this course. You know, I got the usual stuff. Some of them would admit that they weren't too excited about it, but it was a requirement. Occasionally you get a student who would say something interesting, and I would push him. And pretty soon, students were talking honestly. And it got to be uproarious, in fact. And honesty bred honesty. We spent two full periods just talking about how they hated the humanities and why they hated the humanities. And then something emerged. They were bitterly disappointed in the fact that they hated the humanities, because they were sure that if these books had lived for so long, they must be worth something. But why couldn't it be made worth anything? And there were two kinds of courses they didn't like. There are two ways of teaching the humanities they didn't like. One was the lecture method, where the teacher just stands up there and talks about Rousseau. He just tells you all sorts of things about Rousseau. They said, we want to participate. Then there's another kind of class they don't like. That's where the teacher just has discussion and group participation. They didn't like that because nobody knows anything. Well, when you can't lecture at them because they don't like that, and they don't want group discussion because nobody knows anything, what do you do? The answer is, I think, that you get them to know something. And you get them to know something by getting them to care. Now, how do you get them to care? Well, now this is very, very radical. I went out and hired, out of my own pocket, a student, a graduating senior, who was good on groups, encounter groups. Not a pro, you know, he wasn't going to overwhelm them or anything. I announced that I said he was going to be my assistant in the class, and I explained to him what he was going to do. He was going to run sort of sensitivity sessions in that class. Well, that got most of the students furious. They didn't want any of that sort of stuff. And I told them, well, they didn't have to do that. That would just be available for the people who like that sort of thing. Now, I won't go through, this student's name is Bill. Bill and I spent a good bit of time, and they're talking about how we felt that the problem with learning was that people weren't learning because they weren't in touch with their own feelings. They read Rousseau, and they had responses to Rousseau, but they didn't recognize those responses. Sometimes even a response of boredom is a response, but they didn't recognize that. They didn't do it. Sometimes they got excited, but they didn't even know how to deal with their excitement. They certainly didn't know how to deal with one another. They were afraid of speaking up in class for fear that they'll say something stupid. They're afraid of correcting another student who's wandering for fear that they'll insult him, for fear, too, that they might be corrected someday, and they didn't want to be corrected. Well, Bill and I were talking about this, and a number of students began to see that there's a lot to this, and that one of the things that's necessary in a class is that the... What's that? What's going on at 10 o'clock?
Greek. Go ahead.
What?
Greek concert.
Greek. Oh. If you want to go here to Greek concert, I'll wind this up. But a few students did see that how the group related to, or they were willing to gamble that how we related to one another, the honesty and integrity with which we related to one another, might have something to do with learning. And so they went to the first evening session that Bill conducted, group encounter. And they came back and infected the rest of the class. And as a result of these groups, within 2 weeks, that was the most alive group of students I have ever seen in my life. I had to go off and give a paper up in Chicago, and I told them I was going to be gone. The question did not arise whether the class would meet. Of course the class would meet. They don't need me for the class to meet. The students were continually pestering me, not about their grades, but about Rousseau and Nietzsche. It was a short summer session, and consequently people did get behind. But people who got behind got frustrated.
we would sit there, you know, like we've gotten into, let's say, Dostoevsky. We read the Grand Inquisitor, and we read Notes from Underground. And they'd all read the Grand Inquisitor, because that's short. But Notes from Underground is longer. And we started talking about that in class. And, let's say, 15 students out of 30 hadn't really read very far into Notes from Underground. And what usually happens, in fact, the students haven't read, they're sitting there sort of, you crouch down, hoping that no one will see them. Well, we all sit around in a circle. But they weren't doing this. The students who hadn't read it were frantically trying to read it during the class so they could get in on this. Every student was required to keep a journal, which began with simply his reactions to what was going on there, how he felt about this experiment. And he was encouraged to put in that journal his feelings about anything that he thought had anything to do with what was taking place in that class. And it began with students, you know, with things that had nothing to do with Voltaire and Rousseau and Burke and Marx and Mill and Nietzsche. But in almost inevitably, a student who would begin with just his own, you know, maybe he would say, the student would write in there that he just couldn't get into Mill today because he was disappointed in love last night, something. You know, occasionally that would appear in the journals. I didn't encourage that sort of thing. But you know, if a student felt that he said, this is where my head is today. I want to write something. I want to keep a journal of my experiences in this course, my reactions to them. Because the students were sharing these journals with one another, they would turn them in regularly to me, and I'd read them, write comments. And they wanted me to know where they were, and they wanted to get some feedback from me. So they would just write about why they weren't writing. And it's just exciting at the end of the semester to go back and see how the student would get from his not reading the assignment because he was disappointed in love into John Stuart Mill's Essay on Liberty. He would find connections, not phony connections, connections that grew out of where he was. The students said at the end, this must not sound as if I am a great teacher, because what I am telling you about is something that works, and it is not a function of, if education is dependent on having great teachers, we're in trouble, because there aren't very many great teachers around. Here is a system where students can learn in the absence of great teachers. What is required of the teacher is that he be humane. And the students in this class hated it when the semester ended. I've never had that happen before. I'm a pretty good teacher. I'm funny. I'm a good lecturer. You know, and I've always gotten high grades from students, but still, students were always glad to see the course come to an end. Get rid of this. But this one, they weren't. Because they were just so frustrated that there was so much in Nietzsche that they hadn't, that they wanted to get into it. Students were going back, reading the books after the course was over. They were reading books after we had finished them. And there was no way anymore they could be tested on this. They were going back and reading. They were finding connections among these writings. One of the things we did was, if you think of Voltaire, Rousseau, Burke, Mill, Marx, Stendhal, Goethe, Nietzsche, Dostoevsky, they are all concerned with freedom. And one of the exercises that we engaged in early was for the students to just shut their eyes a while and try to remember a time when they felt really free. And then recount how that felt. Silly? Trivial? Not at all. That experience became for those students a kind of touchstone throughout the course. I've been in so many discussions of the meaning of freedom, which were just bull. We talked about freedom continually, and there was almost never any bull. And when there was, it was called bull, quickly.
The students were aware of the complexity and the power of freedom, of joy, of I said, I came to the end of my notes, I said, the great untapped resource is the inner experience of the student. And man, am I convinced that's so. And I think there are ways to get in touch with it, to get students to first be aware of their own feelings, and then read a work and ask, how do I feel about that and why? And then talk to others and write down some things, write their reflections down, and never write down anything about which they don't care. And out of that about which they care is meaningful, and is meaningful to others who read it, who then respond, and real dialogue occurs among students, and between students and teachers. That class taught itself in small groups and large groups, and there was never a question, what are we going to do today? The question always was, what will we have to leave out? What do we know in advance we're not going to get around to? Ah, shut up, hey.
How much of the results you got were due to the fact that the students felt they were part of a special experience? Could this be carried on campus-wide? We run something similar, even more random than you have done. 4 years ago, we started taking one section of freshmen and putting them together so that the same students took my freshmen and took 50 and 50 freshmen. We've made no attempt to bring material together that we had two students to, so they would have found it. So we had to keep it to that. We did no correlation, there was no history of what could be. So the very fact of those students being together really formed, by the time we got to the middle of the quarter, a sense of community that you don't get in a large student body of 2,000. So much so that our results were pretty much the kind, without any effort on our part, without any change in our teaching, just the fact those students got to know each other, help each other, that we're strong, helping the weak, and everybody that we want to be helped. So much so that in every case for the past 4 years, the students are not only not wanted to stop at the end of the year, but they asked for special courses in the block. The group that started 4 years ago still goes through, and they really have become an opportunity. And our question is, would that work if every student on the college were in a special
course? Yeah.
Well, part of the specialness, I think, is that here are 22 isolated students, and they really soon do get ready.
Well, yeah, I think it would, Roald, and here's why. We've had a number of special things for students that have started with great excitement and interest and then fizzled out, including some of these, what students are in the same class, the same students in the same class. We've even paired this with living learning, so they all live, they're half boys, half girls, and all the guys live on one floor of a dormitory, all girls live on the floor in another dormitory, and they have classes in the dorm, integrating living and learning. Those experiments have been a failure. These students were really singled out as very special, but they didn't work for the most part. We've had other special things where one danger that I find with special things is that students' expectations get terribly high. They think some marvelous thing is going to be given to them. And then they don't do what they need to do in order to make it really a meaningful learning experience. Undoubtedly, you can't control for the Hawthorne effect. That's almost the nature of the Hawthorne effect. Any experimental group will show some funny results. But I'm not the only person who's attempted this sort of thing on our campus. And I've known some students who, beginning in the business school, which on our campus pioneered this sort of thing, have now gone through several courses which stressed this. which was approached it this way, sort of the course was grounded on a sensitivity training session. Learning to distinguish feelings and opinions was just the core part of the course. And these students don't run out of gas. They continue to be the to demonstrate learning, to write effectively and concretely, to discuss imaginatively. They read and they inform and edify others. I don't think very much can be attributed to this. That second course, I said the course was split in two. I'd hired this guy only to work in one class. And what I tried to do was use, the other class was not told they were special in any way at all. I tried to use these techniques in that class without telling them they were special. And that class worked as well. Now, you're right. I
don't think that this... I don't think that it's just the novelty of it, because I'm convinced that this is getting at the way learning occurs. That the trick is to get students interested, to find something in which they're, something about which they care, and then hook those things which you feel they ought to learn onto that. And I find that can be done. I think it can be done with anything. It can be done with math, physics, or chemistry, or foreign language. I really think it can be done. And people do learn what they care about.